happening for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, Howard Dean on the defensive for saying he'd be the candidate for guys with Confederate flags on their pickups.
I want to go down to the South and talk to people who don't make any more than anybody else up north, but keep voting Republican against their own economic interests, and that's what I'm saying.
Mississippi and Kentucky elect Republican governors.
The FBI says it knows who was supposed to be the 20th 9/11 hijacker.
And The Way Things Work, author David McCauley on mosques.
I think the thing that I cherish most about the mosque is the same thing I cherish about the cathedrals. You don't actually have to believe in those religions for you to walk into those spaces and think something special is happening here.
These stories and more coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Bush signs into law today a ban on certain types of abortion. But lawsuits challenging the soon-to-be new law have already been filed. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
Since 1995, congressional opponents of the procedure they call partial birth abortion have tried to pass a ban. Twice before, legislation to that end cleared the House and Senate, only to be vetoed each time by President Bill Clinton. But President Bush supports the ban, and his press secretary says Mr. Bush looks forward to signing it in an afternoon ceremony to be held in Washington at the Ronald Reagan Building and International Trade Center. The new law, which would ban certain types of abortion procedures, faces a legal challenge. Lawsuits have been filed by Planned Parenthood, the Center for Reproductive Rights, and the American Civil Liberties Union even before the president signs the measure. They note that the ban contains no exception in cases where a woman's health is at risk, and they argue that it's unconstitutional. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
Republicans have captured two governor's mansions. Voters in Mississippi ousted Democratic Governor Ronnie Musgrove in favor of Republican challenger Haley Barbour. In Kentucky, Republican Congressman Ernie Fletcher defeated Democratic Attorney General Ben Chandler for that seat. With Republican Arnold Schwarzenegger's win last month in California, the GOP now controls 29 governorships around the country. The San Francisco mayoral race, there will be a runoff next month. County Supervisor Gavin Newsom finished on top of the 9-candidate field. He'll face second-place finisher and fellow supervisor Matt Gonzalez, who could be the country's first Green Party mayor. Cy Musiger of member station KQED reports.
Newsom is a wealthy entrepreneur who benefited from his close friendship with the Getty family, but he won over a broad spectrum of voters and the business community by backing tough initiatives against homelessness and panhandling. Outgoing Mayor Willie Brown gave Newsom his start in politics and endorsed his campaign. More progressive San Franciscans split their votes among Matt Gonzalez and three other liberal candidates. Gonzalez will need to gather in supporters from all those campaigns to beat Newsom in a runoff December 9th. San Franciscans also showed their split political personality on some high-profile initiatives. They voted to raise the city's minimum wage to $8.50 an hour, but they also passed an initiative sponsored by Newsom to ban aggressive panhandling in many public places. For NPR News, I'm Cy Musiker in San Francisco.
The World Health Organization says it will take at least 2 years to develop a vaccine to stop SARS. The WHO says while it's being developed, health officials must be prepared to act to control the spread of the disease. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 41 points at 97.94. The Nasdaq Composite Index is down nearly 10 points at 19.48. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the Los Angeles transit strike is in its third week, exasperating some 400,000 bus and rail riders. At the MTA's request, the Mechanics Union is putting the agency's last, best, and final offer up for a vote this Friday. Rachel Miro of member station KPCC reports from Los Angeles.
Neil Silver, president of the Amalgamated Transit Union, said he's confident a majority of his 2,800 rank-and-file members will reject the same contract he's found unacceptable.
It's what this company is trying to jam to the membership. So let them vote on it. We have nothing to hide. We're not afraid of it.
Even officials with the Metropolitan Transportation Authority acknowledge a yes vote is a long shot. Union officials are pushing for arbitration, but the MTA refuses, arguing any judge would be unaccountable to the public. Legally, the agency can hire replacement workers if union members reject the MTA contract. That said, qualified transit mechanics may not be so easy to replace. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Miro in Los Angeles.
The interim chairman of the New York Stock Exchange has named 8 new candidates for an independent board to oversee the exchange. Interim chairman John Reed wants the proposed and smaller board to replace the current one. His proposal is part of a group of reforms intended to improve regulation and end conflicts of interest. Software company Microsoft says it's starting a reward program to convict people who release computer viruses. The program could offer up to $5 million to people who help authorities arrest and convict computer users who maliciously release programs over the Internet. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop introduces the music compilation Shake These Blues, the latest release in the I Heard It on NPR CD series at npr.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Who smoked pot? Who's sensitive to gays? Who'd you like to party with? And, the economy and Iraq. It all came up at last night's debate between 8 Democratic candidates for president, which was sponsored by CNN and Rock the Vote, making for a mostly young audience and young questioners. Sparks flew early on when a young African-American said he was extremely offended by Howard Dean's recent comments about wanting to be the candidate for guys with Confederate flag decals on their pickup trucks, which prompted this exchange between Dean and Reverend Al Sharpton.
Now, I make no apologies for reaching out to poor white people.
But Confederate flags is not for white people. And that sounds more like Stonewall Jackson than Jesse Jackson. And he did, and Jesse Jackson went down. Jesse Jackson went to South Carolina with all of us protesting the flag. The issue's not poor Southern whites. Most poor Southern whites don't wear a Confederate flag, and you ought not try to stereotype that.
All right, let me bring Senator Edwards.
Senator John Edwards of North Carolina attacked Dean, too, prompting this from Dean.
People who vote, who fly the Confederate flag, I think they are wrong, because I think the Confederate flag is a racist symbol. But I think there are a lot of poor people who fly that flag because the Republicans have been dividing us by race since 1968 with their Southern race strategy. I am tired of being divided by race in this country. I'm tired of being divided by abortion, by gay rights. I want to go down to the South and talk to people who don't make any more than anybody else up north, but keep voting Republican against their own economic interests. And that's what I'm saying.
Well, joining us on the line for some perspective on all this is staff reporter Patrick Healy from the Boston Globe. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, Bill.
Well, Patrick, to a degree with all this Confederate flag stuff, you wonder what the fuss is all about now. This has been a standard line from Dean, this Confederate flag line, for months. What's up here?
Well, you're looking at John Edwards from North Carolina, desperate for an issue. He's crept up to number 3 in New Hampshire polls behind Dean Carey, and he's looking to make hay. I think also you had a forum that was looking for some sparks, and they went to Sharpton right away on the Confederate flag issue and said, do you think Dean's racist?
Isn't what Dean is saying absolutely true? Democrats desperately need poor white Southerners to vote for them in 2004.
Right. I mean, he started off well with his statistic, 102,000 kids in South Carolina with no health insurance, largely white. But where he got in trouble, and someone like Edwards from North Carolina, who's positioned himself as the son of a mill worker, can call him on it, is he somehow equates poor white poor white Southerners with sons of the Confederacy, you know, and that suggestion at least leaves him open to attacks by Edwards, but also by John Kerry and Joe Lieberman.
Yeah, but Patrick, you say got himself in trouble, but does this budge a single Dean supporter to look at someone else? Does this change anything or just make a lot of heat and noise?
It makes heat and noise. I mean, it's a real question about whether, you know, Edwards or Kerry could peel off a Dean supporter with this. But I think that they're looking for any kind of ammunition that they can get. Kerry has tried to link the Confederate flag issue with gun control, saying that Howard Dean is too pro-gun, and hoping that that'll sell in, you know, places like New Hampshire and Iowa. We'll see.
You know, another hot button issue last night, gay issues. General Wesley Clark said he had gay friends and said the military needs to rethink the don't ask, don't tell policy. Howard Dean kind of raised some eyebrows by saying he didn't know much about the gay community before signing the civil unions law in Vermont. Well, he only signed that law 5 or 6 years ago. Does that mean he didn't know gays for the 25, 30-odd years before that when he was an adult?
Yeah, that's what a lot of people assumed. I mean, he signed it sort of at the late hour and a day with no fanfare. This was not an issue. Civil unions was not an issue that Howard Dean was originally championing and trying to put forward. I mean, he grew up, in a very privileged, New York, Manhattan, Madison Ave lifestyle, went to Yale. I mean, it wasn't as if he was, sort of circulating in all sorts of different worlds.
So how does it make him come off? Does it make him sound disingenuous or just kind of out of it?
Well, what he's hoping to do is sound like he's someone who's learned on the issue. You know, he's someone who wants to be a champion of equal rights to everyone. You know,
but it sounds calculated, doesn't it?
It's surprising. I mean, especially given how, you know, the Bush reelection folks are probably looking at Dean as somewhat of an easy mark and vulnerable mark on gay rights. I mean, if he comes out and says, well, I favor gay rights now, but 5 years ago I didn't really know anything about the issue. I mean, I think it's going to confuse people more than help them.
If Dean didn't have a particularly great night, as some would argue, did anyone have a particularly great night?
Well, I think that they all tried to entertain in different ways. I mean, the questions, there wasn't a lot of substantive news on, you know, Iraq and the economy, which the Democrats are all trying to win votes on right now. But, in terms of people coming off, I mean, you know, Edwards had a chance to go after Dean on the Confederate flag issue. I mean, Sharpton sounded quite eloquent on this point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Dean himself just looked, picked at. And then I guess it depends what you think what Wesley Clark and Dennis Kucinich look like in turtlenecks. I mean, maybe they'll win somebody over. But
Patrick, just to finish up, and sure, very briefly, if you could, are the Democrats simply hurt at this point and maybe for many months to come by so many candidates?
Yeah, I mean, eight of them up on the stage, and they're just sort of yelling over each other. And the people like Dennis Kucinich, who are trying to get attention for themselves by putting out press releases during the debate saying 20 minutes has gone by and I haven't gotten a single question. I mean, they all sort of tend to drown each other out right now. And I know the Kerry campaign, at least, is very much hoping that there's going to be this winnowing process so that he can try to get some more attention, because he feels like he himself's overshadowed in this.
Staff reporter Patrick Healy from the Boston Globe. Thanks a lot, Patrick.
Thanks, Bill.
Well, outside of personal feelings and personal politics, why is mention of the Confederate flag such a politically loaded question? In part because the South itself is so politically important, which is why the election of two new Republican governors yesterday is also reverberating so loudly today. Tad Beil is a professor of political science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Welcome, Professor Beil.
Good to be with you.
Well, first of all, the election of Haley Barbour in Mississippi, he ousts the only Democratic governor in the Deep South. Ernie Fletcher's victory in Kentucky ends 32 years of Democratic office there. What happened?
What happened? I think, the Republicans are going to say that they happened and that the Democrats are on the way out. But I think there's at least two points that need to be made here. One, the economy in these states is really in deep trouble. People have lost jobs, and so a lot of the votes are we need change.
We saw visits from the president to Mississippi, in particular Haley Barbour, a longtime friend of President Bush's. Wouldn't they associate the president
and the national economy with Haley Barbour, but Haley Barbour won.
Yes, but right now they're voting on governor, and the governor is the person who's been incumbent and should be helping out with economic development efforts and getting more industries in and saving the companies that are there. And what they're doing is blaming the person who's closest to them who's been involved in this. So I think that's part of what was going on, at least in Mississippi and Kentucky. And in Kentucky, you had the additional situation of a sex scandal involving the incumbent Democratic governor, which Republican candidates and Republican Party made sure they wrapped that right around.
And back to Mississippi for a second. You reminded me that Haley Barbour promised that because of his friendship with President Bush, he would bring money to the state.
Well, that may be. But we also are seeing the largest deficit we've seen in a long time, so I don't know how much money will be forthcoming out of the Congress to Mississippi.
Well, now, these elections, and by the way, there may be another new Republican governor by the end of next week as Louisiana chooses a new governor. And next year, at least four Democratic senators from the region step down and put their seats up for election. How do you see the wind blowing in the South?
Well, the South is definitely a very competitive party situation, and the Republicans are winning and Democrats are winning. And right now we're seeing in the past few elections, we have seen Democrats win in some times, and then the Republicans win in the next election, and so forth. So it would be hard to say who's going to win those seats. But, you know, in South Carolina, my guess would be it'd be Republican would be replacing the current incumbent.
You're saying the South is up for grabs?
I think so.
Yeah, and this brings us back to our first question: is that why we're hearing so much battling between the Democratic candidates over this Confederate flag question?
Well, yes. When you look at the Democratic Party and one of the major sources of their strength in the South, it is the African-American black vote. And they certainly were not supporters of the Confederate cause. And so the Democrats are not happy, generally, to have the Confederate flag as an issue and to use the Confederate flag, because somewhere between 30% and 40% of the mainline Democratic vote comes from people who are not happy with that.
Or, Professor, maybe you could say in this case the other candidates are thrilled that Governor Dean has used it because they can attack him on it.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, I think that's kind of an interesting step for the candidate for the Democratic nomination to take.
Well, some would say that Governor Dean might be crazy like a fox. You know, that in fact he may understand the Democratic Party is more likely to get the black vote, and so he is going after the conservative vote that they may not likely get.
Yes, that is something you can do in the general election. The question is, do you do that in the primaries when you're trying to get the nomination? And you've got South Carolina is one of the major primary states that's coming up early.
Well, I'm wondering, too, Haley Barbour, the new governor-elect in Mississippi, made the Confederate flag, or at least a small portion of the state flag that has a Confederate flag, an issue in accusing the incumbent of not being sensitive to feelings of native Mississippians when the incumbent suggested removing or changing the Confederate flag in the state flag. Haley Barbour got votes on that.
Yes, but he's a Republican, and he got a lot of Republican votes. A lot of the people who were supporters of the old Confederate cause, the conservative whites, moved over from being Democrats to Republicans over the last few decades. He was aiming right at them.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if Governor Dean is, as you say, taking the risky chance of aiming at them as well.
I think he is, this early in the game.
You said the South is up for grabs, but so far it's looking good for President Bush's hopes in 2004 in the South.
Yeah, and he did very well in the South, his first election in 2000. But the key to the South could very well be Florida, which was the key to Bush winning the whole presidency.
Oh, no. Once again, we might have to stay up all night and count the votes from Florida?
I hope not. I hope they've spent a little money cleaning things up there. But it's a very difficult situation.
Yeah. Well, Professor Bile, thank you so much.
Okay. Well, it's very good to talk to you.
Tad Bile, professor of political science at the University of North Carolina. He spoke to us from Chapel Hill.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
You can send us mail the old-fashioned way. Mail your letters to Here and Now, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215.
And please tell us how to pronounce your full name and the town you're from.
Well, just ahead, Inside the Mosque with The Way Things Work author and illustrator David McCauley.
And later in the program, Fast Food, the Healthy Version. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
If you've ever wondered how the great cathedrals or pyramids or skyscrapers achieved such majesty, then author and illustrator David McCauley is your man. He's shown how to construct and deconstruct everything from great buildings to computers to phones to you name it. But he'd never shown his readers how to build a mosque until now. David joins us in the studio, and welcome, David.
Thank you.
David, the new title of your book is Mosque. Is that because Islam's so much in the news these days, David, or something you had in mind for a while?
Well, you know, it's something I considered 25 years ago.
Nope.
I really wish I had done it 25 years ago. But no, it's definitely intended to be a timely, useful book. I decided to do it, I think, within 4 days after September 11th.
Oh.
And I was in the middle of another book. And I thought, okay, it's time. You can't just sort of pace back and forth and wring your hands. You've got to do something about this because we seem to be losing control. And I thought, why not go back to the architecture books? I hadn't done one for 10 years at least, and talk about the building of a mosque and the complex of buildings around it.
Well, that's interesting. 4 days after 9/11, you decided to do the book on the mosque. What were you trying to accomplish?
We need information. Is what I basically was the motivation. We need information. What can I do? What can I explain?
To humanize Islam?
To humanize, to remind everybody that we're talking about people here, and people are capable of creating remarkable things, wonderful things. With Cathedral, I talked about what the people of the Middle Ages
in
France.
Your first book, way back in 73.
Exactly. And so I thought, well, let's take on another of those enormous, wonderful buildings and remind people of what these capabilities are.
Tell us about the book a bit, David. It's the story of the creation of an imaginary mosque, but with historical underpinnings.
I always choose an imaginary format because I don't really want to have to deal with real people's names and all the specific stuff that has nothing to do with the sense of the story, with the big idea. But it is the story of the building of a mosque funded by a wealthy admiral in the Ottoman Navy around 1596. This is the time when, that 50 years preceding that, a lot of these mosque complexes had been built by the wealthy ministers and viziers of the Sultan and so on. They had a lot of money to play with, so they could build these extraordinary things. They could build them in relatively short periods of time and so on. And I trace the growth of the building from the foundation, from the collecting of materials, from the gathering of the labor force, to the finishing of the dome and the interior decoration and all that sort of stuff. But I also talk about the other buildings, the baths, the soup kitchen, the school, and a couple of buildings that were built primarily to raise funds by renting space so that the foundation that the admiral had endowed to pay for this could be continued in perpetuity.
And that's typically what precisely happens when a mosque is built. A little community of buildings is built around it, right?
Exactly. And this was particularly appropriate for Istanbul because you're talking about a city that, for a couple of centuries at least, had been on really hard times. And, you know, in 1453 or whenever the Muslim invasion of Istanbul was, they found not a deserted city, but pretty close to it. There was a lot of rebuilding to do. So this idea for the next century was a very important way of bringing that city back to its original splendor.
You must have gone to Istanbul and drunk it in a bit.
Oh, I made my third trip to Istanbul just to go back and spend more time in the neighborhood mosques and surrounding streets and all that sort of stuff. It's a fantastic city.
What's special about mosques? You're a trained architect. That's what you started out to be. What do you cherish the most about a mosque as compared to a cathedral or a synagogue or another religious building, religious buildings we're perhaps more familiar with?
I think the thing that I cherish most about the mosque is the same thing I cherish about the cathedrals. These are buildings that were built to meet the needs of particular religions at particular times, but you don't actually have to believe in those religions. They don't have to be your religions for you to walk into those spaces and think something special is happening here. This is something else.
That's so true. Someone even with a lot of problems with the politics of the Islamic world, perhaps, how could you not walk into the great mosques and not feel that particular serenity? It's not the soaring sense of majesty in a cathedral. It's not the wonderful solemnity of a synagogue. There's a kind of special tranquility in a mosque.
There is.
So?
And it's basically, you know, a very simple open space. And it's all about finding the right environment for the individual to then take his and sometimes her positions on a prayer mat and communicate with their God.
There's a simplicity to the mosque. Is it a simple building to construct?
It is when it's done. If you understand how it's done, I mean, it does make a lot of sense. There's a logic to it. Maybe that's a better word than simple. But the notion of supporting a round roof over a square space without filling that square space with columns is interesting. And you have to sort of think, oh, now how do we do that? And what they did was basically build a ring of these columns or piers around the central square space of the prayer hall, take them up to a certain height, connect them with arches that create basically an octagon or a hexagon, depending on the pattern they'd chosen. And that became the support of the dome. So the dome itself could float, in a sense, above the square space without inhibiting the space in any way.
Perhaps most distinctive about any mosque anywhere in the world is the minaret. Where did that come from?
The minaret is simply a way of getting the muezzin up high enough to be able to call the faithful to prayer. And before these loudspeakers that are now glued to all the minarets, somebody with a voice, with a good voice, had to be able to be heard.
But why is it so delicate, say, this needle that soars into the sky? They could have built a big square chamber as well to have the muezzin go up and call people to prayer.
I think the elegance of the piece of architecture is a direct response to satisfying the needs to get up to that height. All you need is a single staircase, a single spiral staircase in this case. And it's from the spiral staircase that you actually build the minaret. They weren't built with scaffolding. Guys would get in there with a stone on their back and walk up to the top of the staircase, wherever it happened to be, put the stone in place, go back down and get another one. And gradually, this thing would be fashioned from the inside out. It is no more or less than it needs to be to do the job. And that's part of the beauty of it.
What's next for David McCauley? What do you got on the agenda?
The hardest book I think I will ever do, a book on the building of the human body.
Oh, the most complex structure of them all. Most mysterious.
It's a nightmare.
Well, we'll look forward to it as we look forward to every new David McCauley book. David McCauley, thanks so much for joining us on Here and Now.
My pleasure.
David McCauley is author of the new book, Mosque.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll talk with a longtime Southern Democrat about the Democratic Party and his decision to leave politics.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, as Baghdad braces for more insurgent attacks, we get a view from inside the targeted U.S. compound.
Also, is healthy fast food an oxymoron? Stonyfield Farms reacts to consumer demands.
You know, when the organic food movement got going in the 60s and 70s, and believe me, I was there, we were buying and producing with our brains, not our mouths. Somewhere in the last 8 to 10 years, we've all realized that organic is food, and guess what? It has to taste great.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. President Bush is scheduled to sign into law this afternoon legislation banning certain late-term abortions. Opponents who say the ban does not consider the health of the mother are already in court. Even before the measure was to be signed, a hearing was underway in federal court in Nebraska this morning to block implementation of the law. A federal judge there indicates he has serious problems with the ban, saying it could violate the Constitution. In Iraq, U.S. forces in the northern city of Mosul came under attack today as insurgents fired rocket-propelled grenades at a military compound. And a grenade exploded near a military convoy in the city's center. One U.S. soldier was wounded and two Iraqi teenagers were killed in the blast near Mosul's city hall. Separately, a U.S. soldier died of wounds sustained from a non-hostile gunshot at a Baghdad checkpoint. There was testimony in the trial of a Washington, D.C. area sniper suspect, John Allen Muhammad, today that residues of nitroglycerin and other explosives were found, suggesting that shots were fired from the trunk of Muhammad's car. The testimony came as prosecutors began the forensics phase of their case against Muhammad in the shooting death of Dean Myers at a gas station in Manassas, Virginia, 1 year ago. The trial of the second suspect in the case, teenager Lee Boyd Malvo, is set to begin Monday. The serial killer, dubbed the Green River Killer, is now in a Seattle courtroom where he's expected to plead guilty to dozens of counts of first-degree murder. Gary Ridgway is entering the pleas in a bid to dodge the death penalty. He reportedly has been helping police locate bodies and clearing up details in the killings. Construction of two nuclear power plants in North Korea may be halted for at least a year. This amid continuing suspicions that the communist state is building atomic weapons. The U.S. won support from its key allies today to temporarily shut down the project. The U.S.-based Korean Peninsula Energy Organization is building the power plants and is expected to announce a final decision on the project later this month. Microsoft is offering some incentives to stop computer hackers. The software giant is creating a $5 million reward program to help identify and convict people who release worms, viruses, and other destructive programs on the Internet. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are lower. The Dow is down 45 points at 97.92. The Nasdaq is down 11 points at 19.46. The S&P 500 is down 6 points at 10.46.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Insurgents in Iraq struck the American compound in the northern city of Mosul today with rocket-propelled grenades. There were no reports of American casualties. Meanwhile, Baghdad braces for more insurgent attacks. Yesterday, huge explosions rocked the neighborhood around the so-called Green Zone, the two-square-mile U.S. military compound. Joining us on the line from Baghdad is Vivian Walt, reporter for the Boston Globe. Welcome, Vivian.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, you were inside the so-called Green Zone compound in Baghdad, the U.S. compound, yesterday when mortars landed nearby. What happened?
Well, I've gone to the governing council, actually, to interview a couple of council members, ironically, about the state of security in Baghdad when I was just about to enter the building when two rockets exploded very nearby. To be honest, it sounded like it was right in the compound itself. And really, the whole building shook. One of the American security people pulled me into his armored car. We tore across the parking lot, and he got me to the gate safely as quickly as possible and then ordered the governing council members out of their building and back home. So it is getting really a lot more dangerous in Baghdad than I remember it being. I've been here basically since April, since the government fell, and I don't recall a time when the attacks have seemed so persistent and seem to be gaining in intensity, really.
And U.S. allies are obviously shaken. Last month, Bulgaria and Holland moved their diplomats to Jordan, and Spain withdrew some of its diplomats today.
Yes, this raises a whole lot of issues for the U.S. How broad can the coalition go? What is the price for some of their allies or would-be allies getting involved in the coalition? It's not simply diplomats, but the U.S. is really hoping to attract foreign investors, something which looks very dangerous at the moment for people to come in and contemplate getting involved in.
Earlier this week, you wrote an article about donning a burqa to drive around in a car with an Iraqi insurgent. What did you learn from him?
Well, it was really quite an extraordinary experience. The only place he felt safe talking about the violence against American soldiers, which he was very involved in, was the back of my car driving around. He insisted that I dress up completely as if I were a local woman to disguise the fact that he was meeting with a Westerner. I think the thing that I most learned from him is he was not somebody who particularly loved Saddam. He was just a regular Iraqi who was kind of adrift in this new world, didn't quite know where to place himself. And there really are an awful lot of people like that. Unfortunately, the people like that are also well-trained in how to use these weapons, and these weapons are in really enormous supply across Iraq. So you have the potential here for really prolonged and quite bad violence, it seems to me.
He also told you that he'd seen a lot of foreign fighters.
There certainly is an influx of foreign fighters. The guy that I met in Tikrit, who I traveled around with, said that he had actually worked with foreign fighters and that he thought there were about 75 of them around Tikrit, mostly Syrians. So this is really a problem, and Iraqi officials are now in Damascus trying to get the Syrians to crack down on the borders much more strongly than they have been until now.
Hmm. Well, Vivian, thank you.
Thank you.
Vivian Walt, correspondent for the Boston Globe, speaking to us from Baghdad.
The FBI knows who the long, mysterious 20th hijacker was on 9/11. This according to a report in today's USA Today. The FBI is not saying who the person is. Well, joining us on the line is the reporter who broke the story, Tony Losi of USA Today. Hi, Tony.
Hi.
Tony, first remind us why it's always been believed there was a 20th hijacker.
Well, there's been a mystery since 9/11 about why the plane that crashed in Pennsylvania, Flight 93, only had four hijackers on board when the other three jets had five terrorists apiece.
Now, the FBI's not named a name, but who is it suggesting it might be, or is it suggesting who it might be?
There's no suggestion. Basically, from what I was told, this person came into the United States as late as August of 2001, but could not stay for some reason and had to leave the country abruptly and was not around when the 9/11 attacks occurred.
Came in from where? Went where?
It's unclear.
How did you break the story?
Well, I was reading the government's motion that was filed in the appellate court in the Massawi case. This document was made public last Friday, and there's a footnote that hints at this. It makes an oblique, very cryptic reference to al-Qaeda trying to insert new hijackers into the 9/11 attacks as late as August of 2001, and it piqued my interest, and I made some phone calls.
And they confirmed?
Yes.
Now, this will have an impact on the case against Zacharias Moussaoui. Remind us who he is and why.
Mr. Moussaoui was arrested in Minnesota in mid-August of 2001 while he was taking flight lessons. He did not tell the officials who questioned him at the time why he was here. He said that he was here to learn how to fly for personal enjoyment and to do some sightseeing. And then a few weeks later, 9/11 happened. And Mr. Moussaoui has been charged with six conspiracy charges, and basically they're very broad conspiracies, very broad al-Qaeda conspiracies to hijack and crash planes into American targets. And prosecutors would say and do say that the 20th hijacker, whether there was one or wasn't one, doesn't matter to them, that it doesn't matter that Mr. Moussaoui did or did not know all of the details of 9/11. The fact of the matter is, from where they sit, he was part of the overall al-Qaeda conspiracy, and that they say, is enough to convict him.
But Massawi's defense will make something of this.
Oh, obviously, yes, they will, because they have all along, and Moussaoui himself has all along said that you know, he's admitted that he is a member of al-Qaeda and that he was sent here to train for another mission, but he insists that he had no role in 9/11.
In confirming the story, did the FBI give you any indication how they're now going to try to track down this person? This person is believed not to be in the United States, I presume.
That's the assumption, but you know, the FBI still, if this person is in the United States, which I have no reason to believe he is, but if for hypothetical sake if we say that he is, then the FBI would have to have something. They'd have to have a firm case to go after him. If he's abroad, I mean, the FBI doesn't have a jurisdiction abroad.
Yeah.
And you would have to, the United States would have to get cooperation from other nations. So there are a lot of factors here that could be in play, a lot of complicated factors that could be in play that could keep this man from being taken into custody.
Tony Losi is a reporter with USA Today. Thanks, Tony, for joining us.
Thank you.
Still to come, a cholesterol study yields unexpected and dramatic results after a 5-week treatment.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Canadian citizen Maher Arar was expecting a short flight from New York to his home in Montreal back on September 26, 2002. Instead, Arar was detained by U.S. immigration as a suspected terrorist, given no phone call or access to a lawyer, then handed over to Syria, where he was born. After enduring 10 months of torture in a Syrian prison, he was released and returned to Canada. Here is Arar speaking at a press conference yesterday.
Before I tell you who I am and what happened to me, I will tell you who I am not. I am not a terrorist. I am not a member of Al-Qaeda, and I do not know anyone who belongs to this group.
Alex Meave is the Secretary General of Amnesty International in Canada. He helped campaign for Arar's release. He joins us on the line. And Alex, what happened to him while he was in prison in Syria?
It's unbelievable what happened to him. He was held for close to a year in Syria. And at the outset of that period of time, there was 2 weeks before the Syrians acknowledged to anyone, including the Canadian government, that they actually had him in detention. And it was during those 2 weeks that he was extensively and severely tortured. endless beatings, psychological torture, all to obtain a confession, which he has very clearly said is a false confession, that he'd gotten to a point where he would have said anything, signed anything to bring the torture to an end. But equally arresting, I think, and perhaps even more haunting, is his description of the kind of prison conditions that he endured. For 10 months and 10 days of that time period, he was held in a cell that was 3 feet wide, 6 feet deep, and 7 feet high, with no window and no artificial light at all. A jail cell which he described quite aptly in his own words as the grave.
Well, as you know, U.S. officials say that he was deported in the first place because Maher Arar was on a terrorist watch list, that it was because of information from several intelligence agencies, possibly including the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, that put him there. Does he have any sympathy with the fact that U.S. officials were just doing what they felt they needed to do post-9/11?
Oh, I don't think he has any sympathy, given the outrageous and degrading and humiliating way he was treated during 12 days of detention in the United States.
Why was he released from Syria?
We don't know. I think any time someone is released from a situation of unjust imprisonment, it's a multitude of different forces and actors who played a role. There was intense public campaigning led by his very courageous and articulate wife here in Canada. Groups like Amnesty International worked hard on the case. I think all of that comes together.
One last question for you. As this case has unfolded, are you surprised to hear of the relationship that the U.S. and the CIA have with Syria? Apparently there is a very secret but growing intelligence relationship between the two countries. In fact, some U.S. officials are saying off and on the record that the intelligence relationship with Syria is useful because they can do things like torture that the U.S. can't.
I think that is so alarming, and there have, of course, been a mounting number of cases, not only pointing towards Syria in that regard, but a number of other countries where the United States, and now I'm concerned that the Arar case may suggest that my own government here in Canada takes this approach to a certain degree, are willing to allow states like Syria, where obviously there's very little regard for basic human rights and where torture is commonplace, do the dirty work and throw human rights standards out the window and allow things such as the incredible nightmare that Mr. Arar has described to happen and take no action to bring it to an end. It's outrageous, and we have to insist that governments stop allowing that to happen.
Alex Meave, thank you.
Thank you.
Alex Meave is Secretary General of Amnesty International in Canada.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
What started with experiments on mice with clogged arteries may now have led to a breakthrough for people with the same problem. Joining us on the line to explain is Gina Colotta of the New York Times. Gina, welcome.
Hi, thank you, Bill.
Gina, 47 heart attack victims in this study reported in the Journal of the American Medical Association. What was the good news for them?
It was kind of amazing, although it is a very small study, and people say it has to be confirmed, and there's lots of questions that still remain. But what was truly amazing was that when they got infused just five times once a week with an artificial HDL, the so-called good cholesterol, that somehow the volume of plaque in their arteries was reduced by about 4%. Now, you might say, well, what's 4%? That doesn't mean much. But actually, that's more than you would expect with years of treatment with a cholesterol-lowering drug. People said they'd never seen anything like that in that short a time. So the good news was it's a promising avenue to try to say to prevent cholesterol from getting to your arteries. There may be a possibility now of developing drugs to take the cholesterol away from your arteries once it's in there.
There's good cholesterol and bad cholesterol, and what people with problems with clogged arteries do now is primarily take drugs that lower their bad cholesterol. This would increase their good cholesterol?
Yes, now I have to keep cautioning that this is almost like a proof of concept study. They've been having a lot of trouble, drug companies, finding a drug that will, you just take a pill and your good cholesterol will increase. They just couldn't find anything that was just that good, that specific. So they tried something different. Instead of giving people a pill, they just gave them an intravenous infusion of artificial good cholesterol. And that's what seemed to do it for them. So if it turns out that this is the treatment in the end, which is a long way off, but suppose it happens, then one way it might happen is if you have severe heart disease, you might, for example, go into the hospital, get infused with good cholesterol for once a week, let's say for several weeks, and then use other drugs to keep your cholesterol levels low to sort of maintain what you've gotten.
Good cholesterol kind of washes away the plaque that clogs arteries and causes heart attacks, right?
That's the hypothesis. It's called HDL for high-density lipoprotein, and the idea is it goes up to the it comes close to where the plaque is, and it sort of sucks it out. This has been a hypothesis, and everybody always thought that if you had a lot of HDL, it would reduce the plaque in your arteries. But this is like actually really the first proof it really is going to happen in people. What was surprising to everybody was that it was only 5 weeks, and they thought it takes decades to develop this plaque in your arteries. It's not going to go away overnight. In fact, the researcher that directed this study, Dr. Steven Nissen, said he gave it a 1 in 10,000 chance of working. He just didn't think it would be possible.
All started with mice.
They started out with some studies with mice that were genetically engineered to get the same kind of artery clogging heart disease that people get. And to their absolute astonishment, just overnight, this artificial HDL was removing plaque from the mice's arteries. Same thing happened with rabbits. But the question was, mice and rabbits don't normally get heart disease. They're not people. And you would never, never, people said they would never, never expect to see anything very quickly in a human being. That's what made this study so amazing to everybody I spoke to. I was expecting to hear some naysayers, people saying, I don't believe it or whatever. But instead they said, we really need to follow this up. Not that this is the kind of evidence you would ever use to take a drug to market, but this is a really interesting thing that we never thought we would see.
Gina Collado of the New York Times joined us from Princeton, New Jersey. Thanks so much, Gina.
Thank you, Bill.
More than 60% of adults and 15% of children in America are overweight. Costs from obesity-related disease such as type 2 diabetes and heart disease are over $100 billion a year. One culprit? The fast food industry, with their supersized portions of food high in fat and sodium. Stonyfield Farms is testing an alternative fast food restaurant. It promises healthy fast food. Here Now's food guru Scott Haas caught up with Stonyfield Farms CEO Gary Hirschberg at the O Naturals restaurant in Acton, Massachusetts.
To be honest, the whole inspiration for this thing was, as a father driving around feeling hostage to the choices that were out there, I couldn't stand. I coach a lot of soccer. I could not stand being trapped and blackmailed by Golden Arches and so forth.
Let's say I were in a hurry. I've got 45 minutes from lunch. Could I come in here and get a sandwich and leave quickly?
Oh yeah, you can have your food served to you between 90 and 120 seconds from when you've ordered. In that regard, it's competitive with typical fast food.
Why don't you read off some of the things that you offer here?
Okay, sure. Well, on the sandwiches, which is where most people will go today, pesto chicken with roasted root vegetables and brie, Tuscan chicken with tomato, mozzarella, basil, Pan-Asian salmon with roasted root vegetables and brie, my favorite, bison meatloaf. This is Nature Conservancy. Free-range bison.
What does Nature Conservancy mean?
Oh, it's the bison are on Nature Conservancy land, and these bison are free-ranging, all organic, of course.
Now that is meatloaf, everything organic here?
Everything is organic or natural.
What's the difference?
Well, of course, organic is a law now. It's certified. Certified organic has an actual legal meaning, which is that it's been certified as being free of pesticides, herbicides, in the case of dairy, hormones, or antibiotics. Where we can, I think I can say safely that most of our produce is organic most of the time. We, for example, buy all of the organic potatoes, heirloom potatoes, from Arista County, Maine. And when we run out, we've got to either find some somewhere else or go to not organic. So we don't want to make that promise on the menu.
Can we just try some of the food, and then I'm going to hit the road?
You bet. What would you like?
You recommend something. I mean,
what do you tend to like? Do you want a sandwich or a salad?
I like everything.
Since it hasn't been done, why don't we go for a chop chai? Do you like Asian noodles?
I love Asian noodles.
Okay. Can we order a chop chai for this gentleman?
Would you like any protein at that? We have chicken, tofu, salmon.
Do we ever do like omakase here? Like, you know, let the kitchen decide?
Yeah, I'd love to make the bacon.
All right, go ahead.
Okay, I'm throwing on the onions first.
Do you always cook this to order when people order this?
Every time.
Everything's cooked to order.
Yep. And then we add some shredded carrots, sliced mushroom, and spinach. And then we have pre-cut, free-range chicken that we add on the top.
So the amount of time that it took you to cook this to order is about 45 seconds.
Less than a minute, depending on what our specifics are. If there's no protein, it's a lot faster, because the chicken actually takes a lot longer to eat.
But I mean to say, this would actually qualify as fast food.
I agree. Completely.
What I see in front of me, because it is radio, I better describe it. I see it's a blue plate. This must be the blue plate special, and it looks like a Thai dish that you might have at a Thai restaurant. It's the glass noodles and shredded carrots, pieces of tofu or chicken, and let's taste it. Well, it's really delicious. It's not too hot. It's not too cold. It's got a nice temperature. The texture's really firm. I mean, it's intriguing because it was, in fact, cooked to order. You don't taste any grease, but you do taste flavor. You do taste, you know, the salt, the sour, the sweetness, it's got some depth of flavor. You want to have another forkful.
You know, when the organic food movement got going in the 60s and 70s, and believe me, I was there, we were buying and producing with our brains, not our mouths. Somewhere in the last 8 to 10 years, we've all realized that organic is food, and guess what? It has to taste great.
If it doesn't taste great, what's the point?
Right. If it doesn't taste great, you're not even on the game board.
Gary Hirschberg of Stonyfield Farms talked to Here Now's foodie Scott Haas at Au Naturals Restaurant in Acton, Massachusetts.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.
A bill to thin forests through logging is moving through Congress.
And Democratic Senator Zell Miller of Georgia explains his passionate support for President Bush.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.